Accession number 10429, drill 5.
Captain Batchelor, Reel 5.
The Sterling, as I said, was queen of the air once it was in the air. Beautiful controls and maneuverable aeroplane, but it had one very serious disadvantage, and that was that it could not really effectively operate above 14,000 feet, which meant, for instance, that on a sortie to Italy, it could carry no greater bomb load than a Wellington 3 with 2 engines, 5 crew, where the Stirling had 4 engines and 7 crew. But I said earlier it was ideal for mining, though flying in the Baltic and along the Frisian coast and so on. And very effective in when they were transferred to towing gliders and dropping parachutes. But the trouble was that it also, because of its had no locking tail wheels and its one fin, it would tend to swing on takeoff. And until you got directional stability in the tail up, rather like, as I mentioned, though, Wellington 2 in the earlier times, it would tend to swing. The trouble then was that the pilot would correct and overcorrect, and it'd swing in the other way. And the only hope was to abandon the takeoff, cut everything back. The aeroplane had to open the throttles on one side before the other and had to get the tail up to get directional stability. If you started a swing, then overcorrected, it was disastrous. It would go across country in the wrong direction. And on one night, I had 2 major pileups of aircraft destroyed with through swings on takeoff. It ought to have had 2 fins and rudders, and ought to have had locking tail wheel. And of course, it was a bag of tricks with all the electric motors and so on, and troubles with hydraulicking of the engines. That's another story. We were all squadrons, apart from the Halifax squadrons, were pleased to see the advent of the Lancaster. And that, as you know, was the result again of an abortive attempt to launch the Manchester with 2 Rolls-Royce Vulture engines. Was the first time in history that Rolls-Royce had made a move, and it was a disastrous engine. You lost one of those engines and got half your power. As a desperate means, they put 4 Merlin engines into the Manchester and made the Lancaster, which without doubt very much the most effective bomber the Allies had during the war. I've flown a B-17, and they carried, I think, 6,000 pounds for the Americans. We were carrying 16,000 pounds in a Lancaster, and as you know, full with the other later on 9 and 6 1 7 were taking 22,000 pounders and 12,000 pounder bombs. Anyway, Chedborough, we were operating never in daylight, but always at night, and took part in all these big raids of Renault factories and Peenemünde and what have you. We were, I think, the first customers in England to receive the butterfly bomb, which was known in North Africa, on the airfields of North Africa, and this was dropped in containers. And they were about twice the size of a grenade, with the wings that open when they came out of the container, and they spun down to ground. And one night we heard these. Of course, the Germans had only known those times how effective they could have been, not only in bringing in intruders to shoot down aircraft, landing. As I said, we flew without lights even at night, even on landing, but they could still pick up aircraft near or landing. If they'd known all sorts of things, like the butterfly bombs, I mean, occasionally they used to drop the 50-kilo bombs, 112-pounders, sometimes too low to go off, or sometimes ineffectively because they weren't all that big. But now and again we got some bigger bombs. But the butterfly bomb in this case and really reduced our effort for about 2 days because it was scattered all over the place and we had to use a short runway. And it was interesting because we didn't know what the bloody thing was. And I went out in my car because of a dewback, and I spotted these things and using the headlights. And so we had to divert that night on return, but they were all over dispersary. And what I did is told everybody on the tannoy to stay where they were, and we went around and collected them. Next day, we woke up, nobody knew how to deal with them. And we thought we'd be very clever and put lassos over them and then put a pit with gun cotton on the draw the bombs into the pit and explode them that way. Of course, one or two of them went off. We set the others off and we were behind a small row of sandbags and they went hurtling like cricket balls over our heads. They were ingenious little devices. They had watch-like timing devices, which either gave a time delay, and anti-fierce devices. It would have been, if they'd used them much more, they would be, they'd only got to widely target the airfield, and they could have been a major deterrent. Anyway, eventually we had to put a slab of gun cotton in each one and blow each one up individually. Nasty little devices. And there were many other devices the Germans could have used, which have effectively destroyed us. So, really, all in all, that the Stirling was limited performance and therefore limited effectiveness by comparison with the subsequent marks of the Halifax and, of course, the Lancaster. From Chedbur, I went to one or two temporary posts because I took over Shepherd Groves from the Americans because, and Chedbur became a heavy conversion unit, converting crews for onto Stirlings. And we were bombed. We found once we had the control tower shattered, which we had to rebuild. And a number of incidents like that with the crisscross bomb and things, but nobody was killed, except we did lose people previously at Hollington. One amusing instance that at Chedbur's, one night we were sending off aircraft mining. That means, say, six mines length of this room. And this chap swung on takeoff. It was dark. And disappeared into the bomb dunk, and everything went up in smoke. I dashed out my car expecting a station commander to expect to be blown to kingdom come. And what had happened, it had gone through the bomb dump and it had set all the incendiary bays alight, so it was quite a blaze. And it had then gone on to a copse. Well, the copse had taken off the wings and the engines. And of course, all the petrol in the tanks and things went up and the engines and what have, plus the very incendiary bays. But the fuselage, like a torpedo, got into the copse. And there were the crew sitting in the front end, perfectly unharmed, on six undamaged mines. So it had his laughing stock. I always laughed about that because I met the navigator many years afterwards when he was a bursar at the University of London. But some things like that had a funny side. We had, of course, using the grass, occasionally aircraft which couldn't get 100 km down, it was a belly landing on the grass rather than on the concrete, because there was always danger of fire on the concrete. I went off to temporary for a place, Pepto, which was a Wellington OTU, a Canadian OTU, converting people, to giving them a Wellington experience before they went on to Halifax and Lanx squadrons. And that was short-lived, because it was after D-Day, and there was panic stations to replace all the glider pilots we'd lost. So it was converted into a glider pilot training school. I stayed long enough, I thought, hell, I'm out of bomb command. But I stayed long enough to go solo on a Horsa glider, which was quite an experience.
Why?
Well, it's an amusing thing about the Horsa was it was used, as you know, the standard British equipment for the airborne landings at Arnhem and in Normandy and so on. It was a big plywood airplane made by all the furniture makers, and carried, I can't remember, 20, 30 troops. It was towed by Halifax's, Albemarle's, and the Stirling. And the story was the Albemarle, which we had at this place, had been eventually given to the Russians, who burnt the airframes and used the engines. It was a dreadful airplane. But the Horsa was an experience, because once you were you could fly above the slipstream or below the slipstream, and in the slipstream it was very rough. But there was if you lost sight of your towing aircraft, you were in the cloud or something, there was a very important instrument. It was known as the angle of dangle, the danglometer. I had a great laugh down at the airborne place down in Aldershot a year or so ago, because we had bits of a gloss, so they were looking for the danglometer, and that was pretty much almost a piece of string which determined whether you were above or below the tow line, because otherwise you could break away, as was the operation before the one I described on the Norse Hydro was aborted, because they first tried it with taking two gliders to Norway, and that was another story. But the Horsa was interesting, because originally it was designed that the undercarriage, the wheels, would be dropped once it was taken off. But then they found, of course, the wheels had brakes, and for on the ground, in a rather highly congested landing ground, the wheels could be brakes could be used to avoid other aircraft, and so they kept them on to enormous drag, but that didn't really matter on when it was being towed. The other thing was it had an air bottle to work the flaps and work the brakes, and so it was a sort of one-shot system. The beauty of the thing, if you've done a circuit in this thing, slowly losing height, you put the flap down to what the desired mount, which would enable you to point your aircraft where you wanted to land and land there. It was a big lumping thing, but it was amusing. Anyway, I thought I'd been abandoned, but then I was posted later in autumn 44 to take over Mildenhall. Now, Mildenhall today is a huge American base, and in fact the Americans have been there longer than we have, and when I arrived there, it had two Lancaster squadrons, 15, which is still going, and 622, which is now extinct, and that really was a tremendous setup, because we had also a base major servicing unit there, so we had 55 Lancasters on the station at any one time. Each of the squadrons were well equipped with Lancasters and enabled us virtually any day or night to put out from the two squadrons 36 Lancasters, each loaded with a maximum bomb load. They alternate, of course, between bombs and incendiaries, or incendiaries or all bombs, but we could carry 12 1,000 pounders and 4,000 pounders, as I said, a make weight. And these we were on the usual raids on German cities, the Ruhr and what have you, factories and what and daylight escorted raids. Now, we did a lot of that, and we were unique because I got a great interest in cutting down radio chatter on return, because handling 36 aircraft all coming back at the same time was quite a problem. But what we used to do then was to, I'm talking now of a daytime operation, is we would send one squadron of 18 off in boxes of four on an outer circuit of the group going right round, because we couldn't take them all in the circuit, and then bring the other squadron in four at a time into the circuit, nose to tail, spread out evenly, and the others on, and so they could land one rolling and clearing one, well rather one clearing, one run rolling and one on finals. And the reason we were able to do this, returning in formation from bombing raid, was that we and Waddington were the first two bomber stations to get cathode ray direction finding facilities. Fighter Command had used them for a number of all their stations, I think, which enabled returning fighters to get a bearing on their stations and to bring them into land. It couldn't range them, but it would give a homing bearing to the their base. Now, we had a genius character who enabled us to have the virtue of the first airfield surveillance system, inasmuch that we put an H2S, which was normally a downward-looking radar set, upside down in the middle of the airfield, and the scanner, a dish scanner, was tilted to an angle which encompassed the circuit for aircraft at normal circuit height. And then the PPI tube in the control tower was reflected into the CRDF PPI, so that it enabled us not only to give a bearing to an approaching aircraft, but also to identify it in terms of distance from the airfield and of position. So what happened was that we get a box of four in the circuit and watch the four, and the first one would come in having a knowledge okay to land. Number two, number three and number four knew their relative positions and distanced themselves approximately the length of the runway behind their leader and came in. There was no individual calling to the other numbers. They came in spaced relatively correctly. If somebody got a little bit too close, or we would call so-and-so, widen your circuit. If he was, as I said earlier, it is enabled to one aircraft to be clearing, one to be rolling, and one to be on final approaches. We got this down to get 36 aircraft down in intervals of 37 seconds. At night it was a bit more. On the average you would say 40-second intervals. And at night it was took about a minute and a half. But the point was, apart from RT to the leader of each formation, to tell him to lead his formation in, there was no... this chatter between acknowledgements between each individual pilot and the control. It was very effective, perfectly safe, of course, because we were watching the position of each aircraft. And if one had aborted or anything like that, or had made a dud landing, we could always send the others on to continue their circuit. It was perfectly safe because everybody was approaching virtually the same sort of speeds. And as I say, it was possible to of course, if you were at height, you could fly over the scanner or fly at 0 feet under it, but it was so arranged that we could scan and identify aircraft perfectly efficiently in the circuit. Very effective means. I always laughed because the Inspector General of the Air Force had heard some rumour of this, and he'd just come back from the America, where he'd been filled up with a lot of nonsense about blind approach and so on. And first I knew he was arriving, loved to drop in unexpectedly, was that his Ventura, which he flew himself, was approaching. He wanted a radar landing. Well, of course, we'd never heard of a radar landing. And so I dashed down from my office at Milton Hall's, the control tower, and I thought, what the bloody hell are we going to do? And it was a clear day, but overcast. So we thought, well, what we'll do is we'll bring him overhead and turn him around and then take him out towards the coast, a relatively flat land, so he could descend through the crowd and turn him around and bring him in. Perfectly safe. This we did. When I went out to the aircraft, he was a man of few words, and there was stony silence, and I wonder what the hell was wrong. And when he got back to the office, I found out. Well, of course, he expected everything, but what we'd done inadvertently is we'd got him to break cloud well away from Milton Hall, and he'd broken cloud in the middle of a tiger moth flying training school out in East Anglia somewhere. Which was a Belgian elementary flying training school because it came out in front of a cloud of tiger moths. But that was entirely inadvertent because we didn't know, of course, precisely where he was going to break cloud. That was just an incident. But our system, we were three group at that time had started formation flying. Because normally, as you know full well, in every bomber raid at night, everybody went out in what we call the gaggle, every aircraft going. There were sort of turning points and rendezvous points for the stream to pass through gates and to concentrate en route to the target and at the target. But normally, everybody flew at varying heights and varying varied numbers. The danger, of course, if you lit a target up in daylight when it was pitch darkness, everybody get a shot, because as you know full well, there were many aircraft were bombed from chaps above. It was not the chap immediately above you, it was the one chap in front of you above you was the danger. But lots of aircraft came back with tenders of the wings and that thing, and lots of aircraft were lost. In daylight, of course, where you could see each other, and with the alleged security of fighter escorts, our station as a leader in promoting, because of those days we were very effective onslaughts on the oil targets in the Ruhr and around in central Germany. The Germans were very effective with all their millions of slave labour to repair these places. As fast as they were put back into action, we could knock them down again. And of course, as you know full well, in the Ardennes battle, for instance, the Germans ran out of fuel in the final retreat through from France. They were out of fuel and reduced considerably to horse-drawn transport. So we felt we were really hitting them where it hurt, and that was denying them synthetic oil. And our raids were undoubtedly effective, because we would bomb quite happily with H2S and GH through cloud, and you could see black smoke coming up through the cloud. We took part in normal night operations, as I said earlier as well, but it was, we thought, a period in which we were primarily operating in daylight and effectively on targets within reasonable range. I suppose all in all what it really amounted to was the Lancaster was, without any question, the most effective bomber, and was doing the best job possible in the circumstances, with few limits. A very safe aeroplane, because if, for instance, a formation, even the leader, lost an engine, we gave no priority to anybody on three engines. And this all helped boost morale. And I think the other thing I wanted to say, if you look at the scoreboard in the Bomber Command Hall in the RAF Museum, one thing about, I think there was, I had the unique experience, of course, of having three flight squadrons. Often stations have three flight and 1-2 flight squadron, so we were able to put out on the average a much greater effort from the one station and practically all the other bomber stations individually. In other words, we were a good punching force. Just before the end of the war, a week or so, we were called in to take part in Operation Manna, which was feeding the starving Dutch. I think the records say that 18,000 Dutch from starvation in the closing phase of the war. The Germans, amongst others, had breached the dikes and flooded a lot of the country, Walcheren Island in particular, and they'd pinched all the food and they were short themselves, and the Dutch were starving. And it was agreed with the Germans that while they were still there, we could drop food. And so Bomber Command was turned into to dropping supplies for the last week or so of the war, and thousands of tons. The problem was we weren't equipped for dropping foodstuff, and we had to make we could carry much greater weight than we did because of the bulk of the foodstuff. We had to make sort of canvas panniers which were slung in the bomb bay and could be released by a bomb release, and from which showered thousands of sacks of foodstuffs. And we found by experiments that in those days we only had these gunny sacks, and